isn't housed in institutions. Usually institutions are sort of places where it collects and are is displayed. It's not necessarily housed there. And so I think it's always been true. And frankly, it was true when, you know, when I talked to the ages of when they were building museums and they were building all these, the infrastructure for what we would currently call Canadian culture. The reality is they were building all those things on top of a culture that was already there. There was no museums or galleries or libraries or anything like that, Jesse, on these lands for most of the history of these lands. And culture was still very much here. It did not require these institutions. So when I nod my head, it's because I know that, yes, I'm Anishinaabe. Anishinaabe culture has thrived when we've been deprived of any institutional power. We still have our culture. So of course, the answer is yes. I think the challenge for Canada, though, is actually embracing that truth, which is that, because I think for a lot of Canadians and a lot of the way the cultural establishment and the way these sorts of places, these colonial sort of child states create, is by creating institutions. Because that's what they know, is we got to create a giant building made out of stones that looks somewhat castle-like, and then we put stuff in there, and that's culture. When I would suggest, as someone who, you know, is very engaged, like, that's not Canadian culture. And in fact, I think part of the challenge we have is that all of that built was really dedicated to European culture. It was not a reflection of a culture from this place. And I think maybe that is also what we're experiencing, is that that culture that was brought here, that was infused as Canadian culture, as the nation matures, it might decide there's something different that is actually from here in a different way than that was housed in these places that are really vestiges to a different place. And that is a natural evolution. And so, yes, but that does not mean that the chair of the Canada Council wants any of these places to disappear or anything like that. It just means that my perspective is...
Back away slowly from, yeah.
Well, no, but this is, well, I would say, Jesse, this is why I took the job.
Yeah.
To bring this exact perspective, which is that culture exists sort of beyond those walls. And in fact...
Culture is a ferocious living thing. And sometimes actually thrives when it's deprived of this kind of institution. I mean, what do artists complain about in Canada is that our cultural institutions, artists in Canada are liars anyhow. Because when they're in trouble, it's like, we need these institutions. These institutions are crucial. We need these institutions. Have a beer with anybody, and they'll say, these institutions are dusty, old. They're always giving money to the same old people. They won't take any chances. It's, you know, the institutionalization of culture in Canada is a point of frustration for a lot of the people who actually try to make art in Canada.
On the other hand, just like culture is constantly reinventing itself and taking new forms and shapes and imaginations, I think maybe you're talking about like old guard capital I institution, but institutions themselves are living, breathing, you know, human things that help develop and house and promote and create culture as well. So I think that's just something that we need to keep in mind, is that the institutions aren't a museum per se. They're, you know, like, they're not codified. Like, they should be, they should be challenged and evolving like everything else.
And having enjoyed both fringe festivals and pop, like, that, these are institutions, but they're different kinds of institutions. And pop always struck me of like, this is such a celebration of this world in Montreal, of like, you know, and like music performed in old churches and like people I know from a coffee shop working the door, and, you know, a big band that you're excited to see, and also your friend's band from down the street. But you know, how long are you in this now? How long is pop been around?
This will be our 23rd year.
That is an institution. Congratulations.
That's institutional status.
Dan Seligman, Amy Blackmore, Jesse Wente, this has been a really interesting conversation. Thank you for educating me about this. Good luck to you navigating these waters. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
Thank you.
Miigwech.
That is your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read them all. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Tristan Capicchione and Caleb Thompson. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Editorial help this week from Jonathan Goldsby. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
Hello, this is Emilie Nicolas, guest host for Shortcuts this week. I'm here with Nigan Sinclair, who's a writer, a columnist with the Winnipeg Free Press, professor of Native Studies at the University of Manitoba, and author of the forthcoming book, Winnipeg. Hello, Nigan.
Bonjour, Tanse. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's really a pleasure. This week, we're going to be discussing Winnipeg, the book, and mostly the city, and asking what Canada's most Indigenous city can teach us about reconciliation. Welcome to Shortcuts, when we talk about the news.
Reconciliation is hard work.
This project is literally economic reconciliation.
But you know what? Nobody said that truth and reconciliation was going to be an easy path.
A two-day summit in Winnipeg this week. We'll hear from Indigenous leaders across the country.
Hundreds braved the cold and rain to make it out to the second day of Manitowabi.
These are just a few of the many discussion points at today's First Nations Economic Forum.
The trial for a self-declared serial killer continues in a Winnipeg courtroom.
And again, I'm going to quote from you directly because you wrote an op-ed in the Globe and Mail this Monday, and you say, in Winnipeg, the outcome of more than 150 brutal but also inspiring years of Indigenous and Canadian history playing out, one simply can't cherry pick a moment and call it Canada's most violent or more racist city, because Winnipeg is also one of its most remarkable, inclusive, and innovative places at the exact same time. And we've heard some of that even just in the clips that were displayed, which were a summary of the things that have been happening in Winnipeg recently. You see the contrast of, you know, amazing events and also some of the really hard news. How would you sum up what it's like to live in Winnipeg, especially when it comes to, you know, Indigenous presence?
I can tell you that living in Winnipeg, I mean, I've lived here my whole life with a few pit stops elsewhere, but I've always come back to Winnipeg. That's kind of a frequent phrase, is people always say you can't get Winnipeg out of you, no matter how far away you go, because there's a kind of cultural livelihood that happens within the city that is deeply, deeply tied to relationships with Indigenous peoples. Winnipeg is the first site after Confederation. So when Canada is confederated in 1867, the first place that is a treaty is negotiated is in Manitoba. It was in Winnipeg, Treaty 1. And then Treaty 2 is negotiated only a couple weeks later. There was an attempt to make Northwestern Ontario the first treaty, but there was a conflict over resources. And so that first step that takes place in Manitoba is the first baby step of Canada. So the good, the bad, the great, the ugly all comes with that, and particularly the ugly, because the Indian Act is then enforced. The Manitoba Act, which is negotiated by the provisional government of the Métis, then enters Manitoba into Confederation in 1870, which then results in the dispossession of land for Indigenous peoples, particularly the Métis. And so you see the most brutal examples of Canada. And Winnipeg has never been the most racist city in the country, even though magazines call us that. We are the inheritor of Canada's racism. But as a result, we have been working at racism the longest in the country. And so in response to Canada's racism, the Indian Act, the intense violence that's being put across the prairies to settle things like treaties, to settle things like the train line and so on, residential schools, you see the most amount of solutions in Winnipeg. And so it's impossible to call Winnipeg the most whatever, because the fact is that it's not just a place of deep-seated conflict, but it's also a place of deep-seated solutions.
for example, in that column, you outlined some of the events, some of the things that have been happening in Winnipeg just last week. There was an international gathering on Indigenous literature. There was a citywide trade show for Indigenous youth, a national summit on Indigenous identity, a provincial conference on Indigenous education, and one of the largest powwows in North America, all happening in mid-May. In Winnipeg, is that typical?
And one of the most amazing things about all those events is that 50% of the crowds at all of those events, even the powwow, are non-Indigenous peoples. They are Canadian peoples who have deep-seated relationships with Indigenous communities. There's a phrase that I always use, every single Manitoban is sitting beside, working beside, or is married to an Indigenous person, because 20% of the province is Indigenous. That means the other four-fifths, if you were to shake their family tree, you'd find an Indigenous person in it, or they're currently working beside or living beside an Indigenous person. And then on top of that, we've just renamed large portions of the city after Indigenous names in Indigenous languages. And so the mayor, Scott Gillingham, when he ran for election, just like Mayor Brian Bowman before that, who talked about being Métis and I think was able to get votes in that regard, you have to have a platform that engages Indigenous peoples in Manitoba. And the best example of that is, of course, the recent election of Wabkinew with the NDP. The fact is that the NDP had to make a turn towards Indigenous peoples, and now a large part of the cabinet, a large part of the leadership, and even the Conservatives in Manitoba, they have a platform that specifically talks about their MLAs as being Indigenous within the province. The fact is that in Manitoba, you have to be competent to work with Indigenous communities, and I think that that's a sign for the rest of Canada. Every single issue that Canada is going to deal with in the future is going to involve Indigenous peoples, whether it be resources or escalating conflict and the fact that democracy was invented by Indigenous peoples, not in Greece and Europe. It was invented by Indigenous peoples. And so when Europeans learned that and then therefore created things like the parliamentary system where dialogue and debate takes place, those are all things that Indigenous peoples will help Canadians learn about in the future. And so what you're seeing that is ground zero in Winnipeg. And I think Winnipeg and Manitoba are the centers of what is Canada's future.
The argument you're making in your new book, Winnipeg, is that Winnipeg is at the center or at the forefront of reconciliation in Canada. And again, let's try to make it even more concrete for listeners who are not from the city. How would you describe, perhaps in one moment, what reconciliation looks like in Manitoba?
It would be really hard. There are hundreds of moments from the Nuevo Dana project, which is on the largest, going to be a $1 billion investment by First Nations into Winnipeg for an urban reserve, which everybody will benefit from, get a conference center, they get a hotel, get a hockey rink and so on. You could talk about the downtown new museums and health centers that First Nations are and Métis communities are building in the downtown. But I think the best example of what Manitoba looks like or Winnipeg looks like right now is if you go to a Winnipeg Jets game, which all of us go to, it's a really big part of the culture of Manitoba, and it's something that we all get behind. It's kind of this weird moment in which a lot of Indigenous peoples are like, I'm not Canadian, and then there they are wearing a Winnipeg Jets logo with a big maple leaf in the center of it. So it's this weird kind of interesting moment for our community.
It transcends it all.
I think people really realize that it's something that we all get behind. You'll hear the territorial acknowledgement at the Winnipeg Jets game. And the Winnipeg Jets they put it with the national anthem, but they don't ask people to rise. And they also don't really, they just kind of drop it in the middle of what is people cheering and screaming for the Winnipeg Jets. People will stop. They will cheer the territorial acknowledgement and they will rise to recognize it. And this is before the national anthem and the words, please rise for the national anthem. People will cheer for what is ultimately a recognition that they share relationships with Indigenous nations. I don't think that that happens really many other places in the world.
No, and especially given the reputation of hockey, you know, how conservative it can be and how white it can be. That is definitely something very peculiar. Thank you for pointing it out. Is there any other lesson that could be learned as a whole from, you know, what Winnipeg is doing right now?
Well, I mean, here's the bottom line is that whether you like them or not, whether you agree with them or not, whether you are a supporter or not, I don't really care. Justin Trudeau's Liberal government is the first government to care, to engage the issue of Indigenous peoples on a whole scale, wide scale way to do it. I'm not telling you he did great. I'm not telling you that it's perfect, but I'm telling you that it's the most progressive federal government that's ever been engaged on Indigenous issues.
They're trying, is what you're saying.
So I think Justin Trudeau sees what's happening. They see that in the 2015 election, which brought them into power, they saw that Indigenous voters were becoming a force. And in Manitoba, what brought Wab Kanu into the provincial election was the fact that 20,000 first-time voters, all of whom are Indigenous, turned 18. And I think that shows an electorate that is engaged and interested. I think that's what Canada's future looks like, particularly because most of the Indigenous population in Canada is between the age of 15 and 30. The vast majority are. And that means that in places like BC, Alberta, Saskatchewan, you're already seeing this in northwestern Ontario and parts of Saskatchewan. But I think even in Ontario, pockets of Ontario, you're going to see this massive upswing of Indigenous peoples who will then enter into workplaces. We're already in the universities and become the dentists, lawyers, nurses, business owners, carpenters, etc. And that means that every single Canadian will start to look like what Manitoba looks like today.
And so if we're trying to look into the future of Canada, you might as well just go visit Winnipeg or read your book today.
In a point of shameless self-promotion, I guess I would say yes.
Nigan, is there something you'd like us to duly note this week?
So in Winnipeg, the Skibicki trial, Jeremy Skibicki's accused, actually has admitted to killing Morgan Harris, Mercedes Myron, Rebecca Contois, and a woman named, the community has named Buffalo Woman. Of course, these are all Indigenous women. One of my media colleagues called this Manitoba's Robert Picton trial. The coverage of this has been very horrific, and it has really impacted the community. And I think that the media has been right on top of the story. I think my two colleagues, T.R. Weddle at APTN and Tamira Durrani from the Globe and Mail, they've been there every day. On top of that, Dean Pritchard from our newsroom from the Winnipeg Free Press has been there every day to cover this story. But one of the most interesting elements of this story has been that because the defense is arguing that Jeremy Skibicki is not criminally responsible due to mental illness, it's having to make the craziest story into the most understandable, or to try to articulate that this was an individual who not only planned the murders of these women, but then also thought it through meticulously. It's trying to make the most horrific crime into understandable. It's almost like the most unthinkable thinkable. That's also involved a rather difficult relationship between the prosecution and the media. They haven't been able to release, or they haven't released any information to the media. So all these different piecemeal, completely shocking facts are coming out just as kind of matter-of-factly, and the media is having to assemble this story. And so there's a really interesting thing that I covered the trial as well. One of the facts that came out was that there's the DNA of 12 more women that were found in his apartment. That just came out through a witness testimony. There's no press release, there was no information. And so interestingly enough, after every trial, you usually see, when I cover trials, you'll see media that kind of rush out of the room and go individually, run to their car to call in the news to the newsroom. What you actually see in this story is media coming together to assemble the story collectively. And I think that that's a really remarkable thing that people may want to duly note about this story.
Well, that's really interesting. So we're duly noted something that media is doing incredibly well right now as a good example of a best practice. It's rarely the case on this show. I appreciate that change. Duly noted, Nigan.
Do you have a story that you were duly noting this week?
I'm going to draw people's attention, if anybody still not living under a rock has not seen it. There's been a really long essay that has been published in The Breach, which is called CBC Has Whitewashed Israel's Crimes in Gaza. I saw it firsthand. And it's basically a producer of 5 years with the CBC who resigned and tells their perspective on anti-Palestinian bias in the coverage of the war in Gaza and the double standards that they've been seeing there. Last Friday, the CBC News editor-in-chief responded to the allegations of the bias, saying essentially, please look and judge for yourself, and adding that this was one of the most divisive stories that the CBC has had to cover in years, and trying to explain as well the process and the kind of complaints that they're also getting. I think this is a really, really important conversation to follow if we want to have a sense of what's happening inside our newsroom, which is a state of tension inside a newsroom, I really don't think that CBC is the only media that's being affected by this. And obviously, everybody inside the newsroom will be discussing that story and trying to see where they stand on it all week. Have you been following that as well, Nigan?
I can tell you firsthand, this has happened to myself.
What do you mean it has happened to yourself?
When you're an Indigenous reporter or columnist and you comment on this issue, the fact is that there's so much complexity, you can't really do it justice in even a column or even a feature. But the reality is that we're really talking about an issue in which who has a rightful claim to this land? What's the duty of Israel in relation to protecting itself or attacking Hamas? And then, of course, who's dying? How are they dying? Who's covering and who's telling the story? And that's really the tricky balance for so much media in this country. And as an Indigenous person, I often get framed in this, I support one side or the other. I wrote a column in which I talked about, what if we consider that both of them are Indigenous and they are both cousins, which evidence suggests that according to all the way into the Bible. And then what does that ultimately mean for a world to watch this issue where no matter what I do, no matter what I say, you get then labels, whether it be anti-Semitic or whether it be anti-Palestine, not extreme enough to defend what people are calling a genocide, which I too have called a genocide. And then you get seen as being somehow your objectivity, as if objectivity ever exists, somehow is compromised.
Well, also you and I are opinion journalists, so that's kind of our job to tell what we think, and somehow that's even still tricky, is what you're saying.
Well, the reality is this issue is so divisive and frankly gotten to such a point of unreasonability that there is almost no ability to discuss reason. The fact is that it's tens of thousands of Palestinian people, mostly marginalized, mostly children, are suffering, and all of us have to take responsibility for this issue.
We'll be looking to obviously more coverage on that, but also I want to be having more people telling from the inside how they've been living this war as journalists in Canada. I think from whatever news organization, the more we have open conversation about what that's like, I think the better off we're going to be.
Duly noted.
That's Shortcuts for this week. Thank you for joining me. You can email about the episode at emily@canadaland.com. Nigan, where can people find you?
You can get a hold of me at the Winnipeg Free Press, nigan.sinclair@winnipegfreepress.com.
And when people want to get your book, how do they get your book?
So it's sold from McClellan and Stewart, and it's available at bookstores all across the country on May 28th, 2024. That's just in a few days.
Awesome. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
Standing up against racism is an ongoing battle. How will you help?
Everyone should be treated equally, and the legal system should work for the people, not against them. Every day, our network of supporters, lawyers, and educators from across the country continue to fight against injustice and oppression, both in and outside of the courtroom and at all levels of government.
This message is brought to you by the Canadian Anti-Racism Youth Coalition. Visit caryc.ca for more information about how you can stand up and speak out.
Cego.
Bonjour, Anim.
Words and culture weaves conversations with Indigenous language and knowledge keepers to learn, celebrate, and connect. Join us as we delve into distinct Indigenous language families, beginning in February.